Welcome back to another episode of My Neighbors Are Dead. I'm your host, Adam Peacock, and we're all familiar with the big names in horror. Freddy, Jason, Mephisto. But who we're not familiar with are the ones just outside the terror, the ones who didn't get to tell their tales. As a kid, I hated reading. I always felt like I was being punished and I was being made to do something by a teacher or an adult that I didn't want to do. But as I'm getting older, I'm slowly learning to appreciate the value of a good book and a good story and just what it takes to make one of those things. Well, that's what I talked to this week's guest about. That and the importance of dressing for the job you want. But before we get to this week's guest, my buddy Paul P.K. Kingston came by. P.K. is a buddy of mine from Toronto who's a part of the Second City Theater here in Hollywood, and he's also a published author. We talked a little bit about that before we got to Jacob. Enjoy the show. Thanks for doing this, buddy. I know it's a short notice.
And yeah, no worries. My pleasure.
You have a lot to say about horror.
I do.
Talk me through it. When did you start liking it, and what were your first experiences with it?
I've always been into horror, like just as an idea. Mm-hmm. When I was a young kid going to summer camp, it was like I always loved just sitting and listening to ghost stories at the end of the night that your counselor would tell you, and it was just like that kind of thing. Around the age of 11 or 12, I want to say, I went up to my uncle's place in a very, very small town, like barely even visible on a map, called Lion's Head, Ontario. Mm-hmm. I was up there staying with him for the weekend on his farm, and my cousin had basically like convinced her father. She was like, oh, I really want to get this Nightmare on Elm Street movie, and I really want to rent it and watch it tonight. And of course, he knew nothing about it, so we ended up watching Nightmare on Elm Street Dream Warriors that night, and that was pretty much the first horror movie I had ever actually like sat through and watched. And then later on that summer, I was at the cottage, and my other cousin, Drew, he was a huge horror fan as well. So we just started watching more and more and more. Mm-hmm. And then slowly over time, it was just like, I started realizing it was like, I just really had an affinity or an attraction to these movies. And it wasn't any sort of like set theme that I was chasing. Like I wasn't like big on ghost stories or only possession stories or anything like that. It was just the general idea of fear.
Right.
And I just always find that really appealing because it's like fear. It's like it takes you down to your most like primal state. You know, it's like you could be a dude who's like 7'2", weighing like, 450, and you could walk into a haunted house, get surprised, and you will legitimately scream like a 12-year-old girl.
Yeah.
And vice versa. You know, it's like there are 12-year-old girls who will go into a haunted house and they'll be the bravest people in that room.
Right.
And it's just like, it's amazing because it's just like, especially nowadays in a world where social media puts up all these fronts, right? Mm-hmm. And we all play these roles online of what our life is supposed to be like. But when it comes down to fear, it's like it strips all that away and it's the one neutralizer, you know? It just really, really sort of gets people to their core.
Any favorites, anything that personally resonates with you or that you can relate to?
I mean, I've always been a massive fan of the Nightmare on Elm Street series.
Yeah.
Partly because it was one of the first ones I saw, but also because it was just like Freddy Krueger was the perfect marriage of comedy and horror. Mm-hmm. And of course, with my career that eventually moved towards comedy, it was just like the perfect sort of bridge between the two. You know, it was like, I think one of my favorite moments, I'm pretty sure it was Dream Warriors. One of my favorite moments was one of the guys is like jumping around the house. You know, to think about it, maybe Freddy's dead, but either way, one of the Nightmare on Elm Street movies, there's a whole scene where this guy is basically sucked into a TV into a Nintendo game, like original Nintendo,
with the power glove.
Yeah. And then it comes to Freddy Krueger. Yeah, yeah. And he's got his like his knife glove or whatever, and he's like playing it like a power glove.
Yeah, yeah.
And saying, now you're playing with power, and using the actual quotes from the commercials and everything like this. And I was just sitting there like this nerdy little kid just being like, oh my god, he gets me.
You know?
And like, and then yeah, but then you fast forward like a whole bunch of years, and I was working at Second City in Toronto, and weirdly had the day off because it was a time where I was working like 6-7 days a week sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I got a call from my buddy who was working, and he was just like, Freddy's here. And I was like, Freddy, who the hell are you talking about? He's like, Freddy Krueger is here at Second City.
Yeah.
So I literally grabbed my copy of Nightmare on Elm Street 1, sprinted down to Second City, which was like a half hour walk from my apartment at the time.
Yeah.
And sure enough, Robert Englund is sitting right there on the balcony. Got to chat with him for like 20 minutes about the movie, about Second City. He's apparently a huge fan of improv.
He shows up at Second City, or he used to anyways, yeah. I guess quite a bit.
Oh yeah. No, no. Yeah. He even told me the whole story where he was just like, yeah, you know, it's like, I used to bring my, my first wife to Second City in Toronto every time I was in town. We used to watch the old SCTV cast performing on the old fire hall stage and all this sort of thing. And like the dude is like a full on improv nerd.
Yeah. Yeah.
But anyway, so we're sitting there, we're chatting with him, and then we, basically the intermission before the improv set ends, and we basically had to part ways, and I just like had this moment of nerd freak out, and I was like, do you mind if we do like a photo and autograph afterwards? And he's like, of course, whatever, man, sure, yeah, whatever.
Yeah.
Anyway, so we're sitting there for the improv set, and probably one of my favorite moments, and I still describe this to people as a nightmare coming true, is basically I'm sitting there, and the main stage cast is on stage, and they ask for a suggestion for your favorite genre of film. And all of a sudden, from across the aisle, I hear Robert Englund scream out in the Freddy voice, "Torture porn!" like this. And literally, it was the inspiration for the entire improv set. And it was just, it was absolutely amazing.
I hear he is a super nice guy.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I think we've talked about it on here before, but the fact that he does show up at Second City quite a bit.
Oh my God, yeah.
In Chicago, I guess, I wasn't there, but I've heard this story. I forget who it was from, but I guess he would come to a show and get completely hammered,
yep.
And then go backstage, and then very complimentary and like not being mean at all, but would say what he liked about the show, what he didn't, and then sort of like throw out notes to everybody.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I love it.
Well, and I mean, the funny part is too, is it's like, I mean, none of that has changed too.
Right.
Cause I actually ended up getting a great photo that night of him and me. Basically we get there for the photo after the improv set had ended.
Yeah.
And he was just like, he just leans over to me. And at that point I could start smelling the wine on his breath.
Sure. Yeah.
And he just turns to me. He's just like, what do you want? The claws and the tongue? Great. Okay. Like a sort of thing. And then if you zoom in on the picture that I have still on my Facebook profile, but if you zoom in on the picture really, really closely, you can see his tongue is like a deep shade of purple.
I love it.
And just like, just stained with red wine. But just such a nice guy. So approachable, so welcoming, and just, yeah.
All those guys seem to be.
Yeah.
Because they're all just a bunch of dorks.
Like, oh, 100%.
I mean, I used to have this dream when I was a kid that I was friends with Jason Voorhees.
Mm-hmm.
That's stupid. I was bullied.
And
basically, I wanted to kill everybody. but through this show, we got to be, we're sort of friends with Derek Mears now.
Oh, wow.
Who's Jason. Jason in the remake.
Uh-huh.
Super nice guy.
Wow.
We sat we're recording in Second City in Hollywood, and we sat in this office and just talked for like an hour and a half about all the dork stuff that he loved as a kid and how excited he is to do what he does now, because he was like us essentially when he was a kid. So they're all super nice and such a fun, welcoming community.
Well, and that's the thing too, is that it's like when it comes to the horror industry, it's like, you know, so many people shun it away because like from a distance, you know, it's like they don't invest the time towards it. And then they just look at it and it's like, oh, it's all gross stuff and just violence and blah, 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 blah. And it's like, you know, they're only doing this to scare children and so on and so forth. And it's like, I mean, even when I was a kid and I started showing my interest in horror movies, my own mom told me, it's like, oh, why do you watch that stuff? You know, that's made by a bunch of angry old men who sit around a table discussing
really?
How to scare children.
Amazing.
And I literally sat there and was like, that sounds like a dream job.
Yeah,
like,
it sounds great.
That's what I want to do.
Yeah.
And then, so sure enough, like, it's one of those things where like, people just have a tendency to sort of push it away without knowing what it is. But ultimately it's like the whole purpose of horror is to cut right down to the core of humanity and find like the darkest parts of who we are.
Yeah.
And appeal to that. And as a result of that, it's like the people who work in that industry inherently have to be nice. They have to know people.
Yeah.
They have to understand how people work and how to converse and exist with them. To study them and then play them, you know, and it's like whether it's acting, writing, producing, directing, whatever the case might be, if you don't understand humanity, you can't do horror.
It's an outlet too, right? I mean, I don't know. I'm just but like it feels, you know, people like us who probably, I don't know, bullied, angry a lot of the time.
You know, like, absolutely.
It's sort of like an outlet of, you know, I don't want to hurt anybody, but I want to get it out, right? So you do it like with that or heavy metal music.
I'll put it this way. I mean, going back to like most of the 80s and 90s slasher flicks, there's a reason why it's always the popular kids who are the victims. I'm just
saying, right?
Because it's like, because 90% of the time, it's like this stuff is made by the guys who were the outcasts and the nerds who are sitting in the periphery and being like, what am I going to do to this football captain? You know, it's just like, fuck that guy.
Right.
But so it's just one of those.
That's what I didn't like about Cloverfield. Did you,
I did, yeah.
I didn't care that it was a bunch of rich New York yuppies who 100%. Were having it. Like, you have a great life.
Yeah.
There's no problem with your life whatsoever. Oh my God, yeah. I hated it.
Yeah.
I wanted them all to die.
Absolutely.
The best part of it was TJ Miller.
Yeah. which says a lot, too, because it's like, you know, but yeah.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Yeah. No, it's, yeah, it is definitely interesting to see, like, nowadays when, like, currently when new horrors are being put out. There's definitely been a bit of a shift because it's for sure been popularized.
Sure.
And now it's become a trendy style of film once again.
Yeah.
But it's like, yeah, it's definitely missing a little bit of that angle of like the very frustrated 80s and 90s, you mm-hmm. know, built by nerds for nerds kind of thing. And yeah,
it's backed. I mean, I like, you know, now with this all like Jordan Peele stuff, mm-hmm. like the social commentary,
oh my God,
which was always there. Yeah. It just, now it's so, you know,
oh my God,
out there.
I idolize that man.
He's great.
The simple fact that he has come from sketch comedy and moved into writing horror and like really good horror too. Mm-hmm. It's like, it's just, I love that man's work.
What
like,
a fucking Oscar.
Yeah. And I hope he wins more.
Fuck that, dude.
Yeah, seriously, right? You already had Key and Peele.
Yeah, I get it, dude. Yeah. Isn't it enough? Leave some for the rest, you know? Again, something I wanted to talk about quick before we have to talk to, well, I'll tell you who we're talking to in a second. Mm-hmm. You're a published author.
I am.
Talk to me about that.
Yeah. So basically, when I was back in Toronto, about to move down to LA, I was trying to write my first horror screenplay. Mm-hmm. And I was desperately trying to like get that pumped out so I could build up a portfolio before coming down here and have something to show people. Anyway, long story short, the opening scene that I had like crystal clear in my mind, and I'd been sitting on it for a long, long time, was basically one guy walking down the street by himself. And so from an acting perspective, every time I tried to write that opening scene, it was just like stage directions, stage directions, stage directions, stage directions, one line of dialogue, stage directions.
Right,
and so
right,
it's like,
right.
Even just looking at the paper, I was like, this reads like a novel. Mm-hmm. Like, this is absolutely horrid. And like all this stuff like this. And yeah, you know, it's like some actors would say, oh, what a gift. You're letting me explore it. Right. But from my mindset, I was just like, I don't want to hand this off and just assume somebody could do this.
Yeah.
So I kept sitting there and just like rewriting it until eventually I was just like, you know what? I'm just going to write this in literary style and see what I can pull from it and turn into a script. And then sure enough, I finished that first scene and wrote it as the prologue for the book. And next thing I know, it's like, you know, I sat there. I was like, God, I really like it like this. And then I met a friend who works for this website called Wattpad. And Wattpad is like basically, for those that don't know, is like a online platform for up and coming literary writers. And so I was just like, oh yeah, you know, I guess I could upload it there for free just to sort of see if there's any interest or whatever. And within like a week and a half, I had it like 100 reads. And so I was just like, oh my God, okay, maybe I should write the next chapter just to see where it goes. So I wrote the next one and then the next one and the next one and fast forward and 40.
You did it piece by piece?
Yeah, piece by piece, uploaded chapter by chapter. And then fast forward a couple of years and I had 42 chapters up there in a full book. And then next thing I know, I went back and did a second draft of it. And this was now, I was in LA at that point. So I had nothing but time to burn.
Because we all
know how many auditions you get in your first year of being in LA.
Buddy. Yeah.
Anyway.
Got a lot of TV watched.
Yeah. Anyway, long story short, so I basically did the edits on the second draft and re-uploaded it online. And yeah, now I don't know what it's at today, but I know it's somewhere in the neighborhood of like 360 some odd thousand reads. It's now been included in part of the paid stories program on Wattpad, which is basically you can go and read the first six chapters for free and then have to pay to read beyond that. I've now written my second novel and put it up on Wattpad as well, and that one's almost at 20,000. And yeah, so it's just like it's great, and it's just sort of taken off, man. And yeah,
that's great. But yeah, I'm constantly surprised at just how prolific you are about everything.
Oh, thanks, man. Thank you.
What's it like? What's the process like? Is it mind-numbing, soul-crushing? What is it like? Because I've never done it.
Yeah, no, it definitely can be, but it can also be a really cathartic kind of thing too, right? Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, as creators, you know, it's like we always love to just dump that creative weight that's sitting in our brain. You know, it's like every once in a while you get that idea in the shower or while you're sitting on a bus or sitting in traffic or something like that.
Right,
and just be like, God, I got to get this out of here.
Right.
And so you just have a tendency to dump it, right? But then over a while, it's like it almost starts driving itself at one point.
Mm-hmm.
if you really, really invest the time into the characters and everything like that, then they almost tell you where they need to go and what needs to happen next. I mean, granted, for the overarching theme of the first one, it was very much like a biblical apocalypse. So I had to do a bunch of research because I'm not a very religious person. So I had to do a bunch of research to sort of go through the Bible, go through Book of Revelation specifically.
Oh, that's the best one.
And find a bunch of like details in there, because my whole argument that was behind it essentially was that I wanted to sort of shift the semantic debate on the Bible and say, like, this book has been translated hundreds of times. It's been updated a good handful of times over centuries. And what are the chances that somebody has misread this or misinterpreted it or mistranslated? And so anyway, I basically went through and like found all these little semantic moments that could be argued in a different way. And sure enough, long story short, that part of it was very, very frustrating, because you're sitting there and just being like, okay, what could this mean?
Right.
But as far as like the general story itself goes, it was like, yeah, it definitely started to sort of just blossom like a flower and just sort of release its own ideas within the ideas that I had. And in the end of it, it's like, by the time you finish it, it's like, you really do look back at it and go, oh my God, this is like, I can't believe I just did that. You know, it was like, I was more surprised than anybody that I had written a book. Like, if you told me I was going to be a novelist 5 years ago, I would have told you to go fuck yourself. You know, it's like, but now it's just like,
fuck out of here.
Oh yeah. But now it's like, I love it. I mean, granted, no, I have not turned over a screenplay now, and I've been down in LA for 2 years, but ultimately at the same time, it's like, I've discovered this whole range of writing that I never knew I was able to do.
Yeah.
And I actually really enjoy it too.
I think like, the fact that you wrote a book, you do a show, and you know, auditions and everything else that you do in 2 years, if I'm learning this correctly, it's pretty good.
Yeah, no, I'm pretty happy with it. Yeah. I mean, I wish it was a little bit more lucrative for sure. But yeah. I mean, we all wish everything was more lucrative.
Yeah.
But it's definitely, I feel creatively satisfied for sure. Yeah.
That's the thing about moving out here, is because now we have friends who are rich.
Yeah. It's like, oh my God. Yeah. Yeah. I'm watching like some of our friends down here, and it's like, oh yeah, I know, I just bought a house.
Right.
And,
right.
And I'm just like, great, cool. Yeah. I'm going back to my one bedroom apartment where the floor is freezing.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
Great. I drive by one of our friend's sets on Burbank all the time. Yep. When I see it. Yeah. I'm like, God damn it.
Oh yeah. Absolutely.
I mean, it's great for them, but you know.
I mean, the upside of it is, though, is that anytime you put one of those friends into one of your Instagram stories, then immediately your account blows up.
Oh,
so there you go.
Totally,
so it's like, you know, I can piggyback.
I'm building a career of being friends with other with famous rich people.
Hey, anything gets you there, right?
Hey, man. Yeah,
anything
whatever works. Wattpad? Is that what it is?
Yes, Wattpad. So it's WATTPAD. It's like the watts of a light bulb and pad that you write on.
And the name of your story?
Name of my first novel is Goats from Lambs. And then my follow-up novel, which is completely unconnected to the first one, is Butterflies in Glass Cases.
Go read those. Go check it out. PK, thank you so much for coming by, buddy. This was so fun. I would love to keep talking to you all day, but we got to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk to Jacob Appleby from the literary world that we were just talking about.
Yeah.
He's going to come by. Hey, neighbors. Adam and Nate here to talk to you about Patreon. Now, this podcast is possible due to our Patreon patrons, and you can become one by going to patreon.com/myneighborsaredead.
Supporting the show on Patreon's easy. You pay what you can, and in return, you get My Neighbors Are Dead merch, behind-the-scenes info on how we make the show, a shout-out on future episodes, and more.
You may be wondering what we use this money for. Well, we use it for things like production costs, website hosting, traveling for the show, and our monthly meds. We are both severely medicated.
Sad but true. Now, podcasting isn't cheap, and we appreciate any help you can give. If you'd like to see how you can help out the show, go to patreon.com/myneighborsaredead.
Thanks for listening, and now back to the show. Thank you for doing this. You got everything you need right now, or...
Yeah, I do.
Okay,
yeah,
great. Yeah. And did you find the place okay?
Yeah, I mean, Hollywood Boulevard is not the nicest neighborhood to be wandering in.
Agreed.
But, you know,
yeah,
it'll do.
It's a toilet.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking to Jacob Appleby.
Yes.
You, my friend, we I was just talking to my buddy PK. You work in the literary world.
I do.
What is that like? Because you're, well, I'll let you fill me in.
Well, I for years I was working as the assistant to Jackson Harglow at Arcane Publishing. I'm sure you're familiar.
Oh, yeah.
He was the lead publisher for the Sutter Kane novels.
Yeah.
And yeah, so I spent a good handful of years working for Jackson, and it was quite a pleasure and privilege, I must say.
I want to talk about all of that.
Of course.
Let's start at the beginning. Yeah. What got you interested in working in the literary world?
Well, to tell you the truth, I was more so interested in just trying to find a way into the publishing sector. You know,
okay.
It was less about the writing itself. It was more about the being able to anchor myself to somebody who was creating.
Sure, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Because frankly, I find the creation process to be a little contrived at times. You know, people are always trying to sell something, whereas I just wanted to be somebody who was a part of the process, somebody who brought something to the people.
Oh, okay.
You know?
So you're bringing you want to get the thing that's already created. You want it to be created already, then you want to just get it to everybody.
Absolutely.
I think that's
Absolutely.
Great.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, consider me the mailman or the messenger, if you will.
yeah.
But I'm really, really, you know, really sort of focused on giving the people what they want as opposed to giving some sort of self-serving creative what they want.
You so know what drew you to Arcane Publishing?
Well, Arcane Publishing had a great reputation to begin with.
Yeah.
I mean, Sutter Kane is somewhat of a decent horror writer, I would say.
Sure.
You know, he's definitely had some effect on his fan base. You know, I personally was not a huge fan of his early work, but I was a big fan of Mr. Harglow and the way that he sort of approached the publication process. You know, very cutthroat gentleman, very, very put together, always wearing his three-piece suits. You know, he's just the picture of success, if you will.
I always felt like that was a lot of work, not just for him, but for anybody who wears a suit all the time.
Mm.
That's all. You gotta have a lot of suits.
Well, you gotta put in the work if you want to get the pay, right?
So, I guess that's true. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Where do you fall on suits? Three piece, two piece?
I mean, personally, I'm of the same schooling as Mr. Harglow. You know, it's like I always want to look my best. You know, as the old saying goes, dress for the job you want.
Yeah. Right?
So I would always show up in three piece suits. I in fact showed up for my interview in a three piece suit.
You look
knowing
great.
That it would appeal towards him. So.
And what I like about you is that I told you did not have to dress up.
Oh, this is not dressed up.
This is not dressed
no,
up. It gets better than this.
Oh, dressed up would be full. Black tie tails, the whole deal, you
That's
know, putting on the morning suit as they used to refer to it.
The morning suit.
The morning suit, yes.
I'm not asking this to be a smartass. Are there different suits for parts of the day?
Of course there are. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
So like there's an afternoon suit, a dinner suit?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So in the morning suit, typically you want to wear a low cut vest. It's going to be generally the same color as your tuxedo shirt, and
okay.
your bow tie will generally tie into that whole color scheme. Of course, you'll have the tails at the back. You know, it's very classy, almost a regal style tuxedo, if you will.
Oh yeah.
Whereas the afternoon suit is because obviously the sun is at the highest point in the sky. You want to lower a little bit on layers, so you lose the vest. You keep the shirt, you keep the bow tie, but you get a little bit of a thinner jacket, more of a linen feel to it. You know,
that's way more thought than I put into it,
oh,
and
of course.
I feel bad now.
No, well, you should.
I'm a Marshalls guy. I'm just whatever's on sale. I just, you know.
I've met your kind before, and I understand. But you know, it's one of those things where if you truly want to embrace the possibility of life, you need to dress for every occasion.
I'm really going to relook at how I dress now because I have a lot of t-shirts and jeans.
It's one way of looking at things.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So you dress for the job you want. I like
yes.
that. I like
yes.
that. Maybe that's why I am where I am in life is I'm just not dressing for the job that I want.
I mean, I'm not going to say it's helping you for
yeah.
sure, but yeah.
Yeah. I'll have to look at that. I could use a few more ducats.
Mm-hmm.
So you're at Arcane Publishing. You're
yes.
working with Mr. Harglow. What is that like? What is the general atmosphere of Arcane Publishing? What's a day to day for you?
Well, I mean, similar to the way that Mr. Harglow dresses, I mean, he runs a very tight ship. Everything is very polished. Everything has its place. You know, the average day for me would be showing up at approximately 5:30 in the morning to make sure that Mr. Harglow's coffee and breakfast are set up and ready to go. I make sure that the most recent issues of the manuscripts have been placed on his desk in the order in which he likes to read them, which
yeah.
of course is alphabetically.
Wow.
You know, and then of course, you know, I have my random list of tasks and duties I need to perform over the course of the day. Make sure all the departments are delivered delivering any of the information that Mr. Harglow requires. I sort of consider myself to be a bit of an interdepartmental liaison, if you will. You know, I jump from the publicity section over to the publishing section, over to the marketing section. You know, everybody knows my name and they know who I am and they know who I work for. So it definitely definitely helps in that regard. I'm sort of the face, if you will, of the behind the scenes of Arcane Publishing.
I gotta tell you, I really admire how like just studious you are to your job, just how like attention to detail that you have.
Well, I mean, you don't really have a choice in this kind of industry, you know?
I hear it's pretty cutthroat.
It is quite cutthroat.
So talk to me a little bit about I don't even know if this is a touchy subject or what, but talk to me a little bit about the whole Sutter Kane incident.
I mean, it's not a touchy subject for me, as far as I'm concerned. Mm-hmm. I mean, if in my opinion, I think it was one of the greatest publicity moves we've ever made at Arcane Publishing.
It's pretty ballsy.
Well, some would say so, sure. Yeah. Others would say, look at the sales that turned over, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you've got one of the top horror novelists in the industry. Mm-hmm. He has pumped out seven books up to that point. We were about to release his eighth and final novel.
In the Mouth of Madness.
In the Mouth of Madness was going to be his eighth and final novel. And we were sitting there and, you know, he already had a great following, a great readership, a great base of fans. Sure, some of those fans were a little less stable, a little less put together, not necessarily the most mentally capable individuals,
sure,
if I may say so. But ultimately, in the end, I mean, how do you appeal? How do you pull in that new audience? How do you tweak people's interest, you know? Mm-hmm. And the best way you can do that is to take somebody who is such a prolific writer and make them disappear. Create the mystery for the fans to figure out.
Yeah.
Right?
And is there sort of like a McDonald's Monopoly thing where you can kind of play along with it, or what do you do?
I'm not familiar with McDonald's Monopoly.
Oh, it's the best. You go and you get like a value meal and they give you like little McDonald's Monopoly pieces. And if you build out a board, you win prizes.
I see.
The grand prize being if you get Boardwalk and Park Place, you think you get $1 million.
Huh. Okay. Well, I mean, I guess that suits some people. What I would say is that it was less of a scavenger hunt for the fans, more of an attempt to sort of pull in the press, you know, get a little bit more publicity behind it for free. You know, as you know, any publicity is good publicity in this game.
Of course. Right?
and while we could push, you know, we could push the hell out of any book that we're publishing, we could market it, we could put on, you know, TV commercials, we could put radio ads, we could, you know, put out print ads as much as we want, but it's only going to hit a certain market.
Yeah.
When you start involving the regular day-to-day news, when you make prime time news broadcasts, that's where you hit the heart of the matter. That's where you start affecting families. When you have children sitting down to eat dinner with their parents and finding out that a man has gone missing, it terrifies them. They start asking questions, and then their parents start wondering, what did happen to Sutter Kane?
Is that normal dinner time conversation?
Of course.
Really?
Well, in my home, we always watch the night news. You know, I personally grew up on a steady diet of suspicions of communism, murder mysteries, all these sorts of things. And my parents were always very candid about how the world really was.
That's
you know?
A lot for a kid.
Well, some would say it's a lot for a kid. Some would say it builds perspective and character.
How old were you when this was going on?
Approximately 8.
That's very young.
Yes.
That's very young. Do you take that with you to school? Like, that must inform your worldview in some way. Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, here's the thing is that life can be fragile,
right?
It's no secret. Life can be fragile. And ultimately at the end of each day, if you do not value the fragility of life, then you do not understand the purpose of life.
That's pretty profound.
So if as a child at 8 years old, of course I wanted to know more about this. I wanted to understand about these children that fell into wells, you know, what would that life be like?
Yeah.
You know, how would you change your clothes in a well, right? How would you stay stylish? How would you appeal to, you know, the mindset of a mass murderer? You know, how did they dress? How did they live? You know?
I'm really starting to reevaluate my life here because when I was 8, all I really wanted to do was play baseball.
Well.
But here I sit and here you sit, and I think the proof is in the pudding.
To each their own.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Any inkling that maybe Sutter Kane was trying to bring about the end of the world? I mean, did you, anything lead towards that?
I mean there were conversations surrounding that, but it was always just speculation. I mean, I mean, how is an author really going to bring the end of the world around?
It seems ridiculous, right?
Of course, yeah. I mean, yes, he would. He was a great world builder. Yeah. From what I heard from some of his more involved editors and publicists, you know, they said there was definitely some affectation from his books on the lesser-minded readers. Obviously, there was that whole issue with his agent where he was shot in the middle of the day while wielding an axe after murdering his family. But, you know, I mean, those are people who don't understand how the world works. You know, these are the fragile people I'm telling you about, where they don't understand the gravity of the day-to-day life, the grind, if you will.
I think, unfortunately, though, you know, the amount of with which it happens when people use those as an excuse to do bad things, I think it really waters down the true moments when that actually happens. Like, oh my God, I shot the president because a book told me to. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I think when you make up lies like that, it really waters down somebody who is that powerful of an author who can bring forth the end of the world.
But again, I mean, it begs the question, is that in fact possible, right? I mean, sure, you could have an author that creates a work that's as convincing as possible, and maybe that work inspires some action as a result of the fans, right?
Yeah.
But it is not going to lead to a global collapse. You know, I mean, frankly, another individual who was unfortunately subject to Sutter Kane's manipulation, if you will, was John Trent. The insurance investigator that we brought in, which of course was part of the publicity stunt. We were merely just trying to bring in a freelance insurance investigator to just, you know, go out there and spread this rumor that we had lost this author.
You guys really went full tilt with this.
Well, I mean, here's the thing, is that you either go all in or you don't go in at all, right? Don't sit down at the poker table if you're not willing to lose all the chips.
That's,
you know,
yeah,
absolutely. But point being is that when we brought in this John Trent individual, you know, he seemed like a level-headed individual. He seemed like a critical mind. He seemed like somebody who would help to push our narrative forward.
Yeah.
And then of course would come back once the book had been released, and he would simply just be like, this was an excellent choice. You know, you duped me, if you will, you know, none of us were expecting the result that actually did happen.
Are you allowed to talk about that?
I mean, technically I'm on NDA, but now that, you know, Arcane Publishing is no longer, I feel I can discuss this in the open, I guess.
Sure.
So John Trent did come back from his investigation towards the missing of the disappearance of Sutter Kane. Uh-huh. And sure enough, he seemingly had created his own narrative along the way, something involving a woman that he referred to as Linda, I believe it was.
Oh, yeah, Linda, yeah.
Linda, who was supposedly some sort of editor that had gone with him. I've had worked for Arcane for nearly 8 years by that point, and I'd never met a woman named Linda.
Yeah, you guys were in full denial mode at that point.
Well,
right?
You can't deny something that never happened.
That is very true. Yeah.
So I was merely speaking my truth, as was everyone at Arcane Publishing. But this Linda lady that he claims was sent on this investigation with him, and of course never came back because, frankly, she never existed.
Right.
But when Mr. Trent came back, I guess I had overestimated his ability to remain cognizant of his, you know, of his sanity. Yeah. He clearly was one of the weaker minded readers, and it was unfortunate that we hadn't spotted it ahead of time. But as I said before, you know, to each their own.
You never really know somebody, do you?
Well, I guess not. You know,
you never really know somebody.
Yes.
I'm just curious, and I don't mean to divert too hard, but you seem, again, so passionate about what you do, so you're crossing the T's and dotting the I's. Mm-hmm. Where does that leave room in your life for any personal time? Are you, like, relationships? What do you do for fun?
I mean, to tell you the truth, I loved my job while I still had it. Before Arcane Publishing closed, I loved my job. I was married to my job. That was the only relationship I really needed.
Sure. Married to the work.
Of course. Yes. I mean, you know, some people in this life, they seek companionship. They seek validity through a significant other. I personally just sought validity through success. Frankly, why would I want to share that with somebody else if I was the only one who built it?
Yeah.
You know?
What's yours is yours.
Exactly.
I get that.
Exactly.
I get that big time. Yeah.
And I mean, I've seen, you know, countless celebrities out there who, you know, they go and they get married because they're seeking that companionship, that partnership, and then they get taken for half of their earnings, you know, because it was all just a charade.
Again, you never really know somebody.
Exactly.
Where'd you end up? Where are you at now? What can we keep an eye out for you?
Currently, I am actually beginning my own publishing company.
Really?
Yes. We're very, very new to the scene, but we are hoping to perhaps catch on to this sort of tail end of this whole Sutter Kane thing and dive into the gap that has been created by Arcane Publishing within the horror industry. We have yet to book any writers.
Okay.
Everybody seems very caught up on this whole aftermath of the Sutter Kane disappearance.
Sure.
Not to mention the recent spike in suicides and mass murders as a result of Sutter Kane's final novel. But nonetheless, you know, we're pushing forward and we've got a hope for a very bright future.
Hey, so. No press is bad press.
Exactly.
I mean, I think you should ride that horse while you can. Strike while the iron's hot. You know?
Absolutely.
Can people submit to you? Can we, if we have people out there who are listening who might want to submit novels or
Absolutely.
Manuscripts to your company?
Yes, for sure. So if they wanted to reach out to our company, they can reach out to us via email for submissions. We prefer if they send a full manuscript. And when I say full manuscript, I say minimum 600 pages typed, single spaced, 12-point font, preferably Times New Roman font, because mm-hmm. that's easiest on the eyes. But if you choose Arial, that'll work.
Sure.
Yes, you can send it to info@applebypublishing.ca.
Dot CA.
We are currently based out of Canada, based on property value and so on and so forth.
Love Canada.
Yes.
Well, that's great. If you have a manuscript, 600 pages.
600 pages fully typed, minimum.
Get it to Appleby typed. Publishing.
Yes.
And look, I would never condone this or would I suggest it. But if you happen to kill yourself after reading one of these books, wouldn't be the worst thing in the world.
I mean, we're already overpopulated as it is.
Thin the herd. Well, Jacob, thank you so much for coming by.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to My Neighbors Are Dead. I'm your host, Adam Peacock. The show was produced by myself and Nate Dufort, with editing done by Nate Dufort. Original music was composed by Jesse Case, with additional music by Dane Halverson. Our artwork was done by Mark Nishan. Jacob Appleby was played by Paul P.K. Kingston. You can catch P.K. as a member of the Canuck Is Fuck show at Second City Hollywood, running Saturdays at 7 o'clock. If you'd like to support My Neighbors Are Dead while getting unique swag and a look behind the scenes of how we make the show, go to patreon.com/mynabersaredead. No amount is too small, and every bit helps. If you have yet to rate and review the show on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, please take a second to do so now. It helps us grow, and it helps new neighbors find the show. And you can find us on Facebook and at Instagram at My Neighbors Are Dead, and on Twitter at My Dead Neighbors. Stop by, give us a follow, and share your favorite episodes. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Have you ever encountered an unexplained hairy bipedal hominid in the woods?
Have you received telepathic messages from an unidentified aerial phenomenon?
If so, then you need to listen to Bigfoot Collectors Club. I'm Michael McMillan.
And I'm Bryce Johnson.
And together with super producer
Riley Bray,
we make up the Bigfoot Collectors Club.
That's right. Every week we talk to actors, comedians, writers, and paranormal experts about their personal paranormal histories and share stories of high strangeness.
Like the time when we talked to Craig Ferguson about the Loch Ness Monster and when a sea witch told him he had raven magic.
Or the time I asked Pitch Perfect's Anna Camp her opinion on cattle mutilations. Past guests have included Rachel Bloom, Jen Kirkman, Paul F. Tompkins, Bobcat Goldthwait, and more.
So if you've ever been abducted alongside five reindeer by an alien with drills for hands, or witnessed Bigfoot crawl out of an interdimensional portal,
don't laugh, happens all the time.
Then check out Bigfoot Collectors Club on Campfire Media or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bigfoot Collectors Club, you're here to believe us.
Wait, is that how it goes?
Campfire.